All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. You can email us, as always, at radio@thefederalist.com. We're coming to you to talk to you today about a number of the different economic factors that have resulted from the various government lockdowns and a number of other questions that are facing us in America today. And joining me to talk about this is Orfe Duvungi. He is a chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute in Chicago. You can find his work all over the place, lots of different publications. His background is as an economist, someone who studied in England. Orfe, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing at Illinois Policy Institute, and particularly what you've been finding as it relates to the way that the lockdown has impacted various groups within our communities.
Yeah, that's right. So, it's no surprise, I think, to everyone listening to us that economic activity has declined substantially in 2020. Right before the lockdown, as individuals began to perceive the risk of getting sick, they had, stopped or at least, reduced their mobility, economic activity. But the lockdowns actually exacerbated the decline in economic activity because it just, took everything to a standstill, right? So state governors across the country decided that some jobs or industries were essential and others were not. And so the job losses did not hit everyone equally. In fact, what we found was that out of the 1.2 million jobs that were lost in the state of Illinois, it was the majority's losses came to women and minorities, Black and Hispanic women in particular.
Those lockdowns obviously had a disparate impact in terms of the ability of people to work from home and fulfill their functions within their current jobs. It was really frustrating for me to see this because I felt like a lot of the policy in Washington at the federal level was being dictated by people who were perfectly comfortable working from home. Bureaucrats and government workers who can work at home for an extended amount of time. They don't have to be in an office. What did you find in terms of the differences and the way that this impacted people who are working in jobs where they do have to go somewhere to do it?
Oh, absolutely. It's clear that highly educated workers and government workers have the luxury of being able to sit at home and work from home. But the majority of Americans don't have that luxury. In fact, only about 37% of all jobs in the U.S. can be performed at home, which means that a lockdown will have substantial negative effects on employment. Why does that matter? People have to pay their bills, right? So bills come due, you start at the start of the month, bills come due, and then you have a choice. You face a choice between, paying your bills and staying current on your bills and feeding your family, right? Knowing very well that your job is no longer there and that you don't know when your next paycheck is coming. And so government workers were mostly shielded from the decline in the job losses. And as private sector workers lost their jobs, the worst to report is really that it was, people who are already behind, Blacks and Hispanic relative to whites, that had to suffer the most disproportionate job losses.
One of the things that people are obviously concerned about within this economy and have been, in recent years is the situation that we saw in the wake of the financial crisis, where so many minority communities, particularly Black Americans, were not experiencing the kind of job and wage growth that was being experienced in other areas of the economy. Do you think this is the type of situation where, given the lockdowns that have happened and the disproportionate hit that you're talking about, that those communities are going to have a much harder slog coming back from this government-instituted lockdown than various white Americans, and particularly those who have the opportunity to go back to work in a quicker fashion?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, this is what worries most economists about the recovery, right? So when you heard about the potential for a V-shaped recovery, well, that's really gone. That's gone out of the window. The lockdowns killed that. The fact that so many workers, and those workers, by the way, tend to take a longer time to find stable employment. The fact that those workers are the ones that lost their jobs means that, you know, the recovery is going to be much slower. But, you know, very important point to highlight here. The disproportionate losses, you know, even just comparing private sector with state government, right? So even though economic activity slowed and tax revenues are going to slow in a downturn, state government kind of kept on their payrolls. In fact, in Illinois, state workers are due to get a pay increase in the middle of a downturn, while private sector workers shed more than three times as many jobs as state government. So while private sector workers are suffering in the midst of the worst downturn we've seen since the Great Depression, you know, you got state government workers getting pay raises. That's really unfair. And then you add to that the fact that public health policy claims that they were trying to help those communities. Well, their public health policy ended up hurting those communities more than protecting them. And by communities, we're talking about, you know, Black women, Hispanic women who have suffered. You know, you're talking about one in five Black women lost their job. One in five Hispanic women lost their jobs. That's absolutely terrible. And that's really unfortunate.
There's a debate going on at the federal level now that will, I'm sure, proceed in the coming months regarding the justification for bailing out states across the country that have been facing financial problems, fiscal problems in various ways and for various reasons. In particular, the conversation is going to include New York. It's going to include California. It's also going to include Illinois, of course. And you're going to see the shift be because of the coronavirus, because of the lockdown, we need to have a lot of largesse, a lot of federal tax money come our way that could then be used to pay off pension obligations, things that were not originally, you know, in any way really impacted by coronavirus, or at least not directly. What's your argument about that? And what do you think the feds ought to do when it comes to the way that they treat states, particularly those who have been pretty fiscally irresponsible in the promises that they've made?
You know, in a downturn, it's hard to argue against helping families and businesses. In fact, if you think about the role of government a little bit, you know, when you pay insurance, homeowners insurance, you pay homeowners insurance because, you know, in the event of a tornado that rips off the roof, you expect your insurance company to be there to pay for damages. Unfortunately, government in many states have failed to build up a rainy day fund for rainy days. And I'm talking specifically about Illinois here. You know, you have a state like the state of Illinois that's been irresponsible for decades fiscally irresponsible for decades. And then we get to a rainy day and there's no rainy day fund to pay for government expenditures, for government services. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, the federal government should not be in the business of bailing out states. I think that we should be focusing on families and businesses, keeping businesses solvent. You know, there's research that shows that most small businesses, by the way, small businesses in Illinois employ 60%, create 60% of all new jobs every year, right? So we should really make sure that there are no mass business failures if we're going to hope for a recovery that will, by the way, disproportionately help Black women and Hispanic women. We were the biggest losers as a result of the state imposed lockdown.
We're talking today to Dr. Orfe Devungay. He is the chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute. You can also follow him on Twitter at PolicyQuantsPhD. I'm curious in terms of your own personal perspective on what's been going on of late in these communities. We've seen the breakout of protest and outrage that has followed the tragic death of George Floyd, frustrations with long-term issues related to policing and the like are obviously something that's been ever present in American society in recent years. But this type of outburst seems to be different in terms of scale, perhaps fueled by the extended lockdowns that people are so tired of. One of the things that I'm curious about to get your perspective on is the way that this has played out in terms of destruction, the destruction of property, the burning of various stores and places of business, including many that are within minority communities and owned by minority small business owners. What kind of argument that can be given when you see a group of white Americans shouting Black Lives Matter as they burn a black man's place of business, as they did, for example, in a couple of places that in the Midwest? What argument can be given to push back against them and to say, why are you doing this thing?
Oh, you know, it's really unfortunate. So let me be clear. There's been decades and decades of racial injustice in this country, right? So blacks and Hispanics are more likely to be victims of the use of force, police use of force, than similar white Americans. That's a fact. So there's plenty of research to show that. But on top of that, you have decades and decades of being left back in terms of economic injustice, labor market discrimination, but also health disparities, right? So I wrote recently about that. You know, the fact that blacks are more likely to be unemployed than whites, and that there's this huge gap in the labor market, means that black communities will be also plagued with higher pre-existing conditions that we've seen translate into more hospitalizations related to COVID-19. So there are economic and health disparities that need to be addressed. The reason I think that this recent event took such a huge scale is because of the technology, right? The private sector gave us the smartphone, and we're really, really, really happy to see that actually events like that are actually being recorded, and maybe they will be able to, you know, bring about change. Now, as to the difference between protesters and looters, looters destroy economic property. They stifle economic growth. So what's going to happen is actually, we're going to see this political polarization, but also this racial divide is actually hurting the economy, is hurting our ability to bounce back. And anything that hurts our ability to bounce back is disproportionately hurting the same people that we're fighting for, which are these black men and women and Hispanic men and women who are suffering in this time. Going back to the economics of this whole thing, we need a strong recovery. And the only way to see a strong recovery is for this country to come together and for looters to stop looting. Our community to address these disparities, this police disparity, so that we can, actually bounce back from the economic damage that's been caused by COVID-19 and the lockdowns.
You're an economist, so I'm not going to ask you to solve the police reform issues, but I will just ask your opinion. What are some of the things that we can be doing or that we ought to be doing in order to make sure that the interactions between police officers and individuals, whether in the minority communities that we're talking about or elsewhere, are limited in such a way that we decrease the number of these events that happen? And just to give an example of that, in this instance, George Floyd was called out for passing a counterfeit bill. In the instance of Eric Garner, he was selling loose cigarettes. These are very minor infractions.
That's right.
But they led to confrontations with the police that ultimately resulted in their death. There's the whole concept of broken windows policing, which is a little bit misframed when it's talked about in the media. We've had guests on that about that topic before, and we will again. But to me, it just seems like these are a lot of low-level instances that should result in a minor fine at most, or maybe shouldn't even be really policed. Is there a way to decrease the kind of interactions that could lead to the deaths of innocent people, or if not innocent, then people who are guilty of crimes that are very low level?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm going to speak as an economist. The strength of police unions ought to be addressed, right? Mm-hmm. Police already, police in America already have all of the power, right? So we've given up all of our liberties, our freedoms to police, because we expect them to serve the community and to prevent, violent crime, prevent crime altogether. But police unions give police officers more power, even more power, because if you can see all the evidence points to the fact that when we complain about something, you're right, the police, non-justified police use of force, when we complain about something, those complaints are usually ignored. And the reason why they're ignored is because police unions contribute to politicians. Police unions have just way too much power. So this is a big problem that needs to be addressed in America. And we see that a lot with public sector unions, throughout, right? So, in Illinois, we have a massive pension problem that's actually hurting economic growth because, state government unions are so powerful and give so much money to politicians in the first place. So these unions actually prevent reforms and prevent justice. And so that, I think that's where we ought to start, looking at the unfair power, bargaining power that police officers have because of their unions.
One of the things that I think people, expect from a police force is that they're going to be able to maintain order, that they are going to not just, that solve crimes when it comes to murders or theft and the like, but that they'll be able to keep an orderly and peaceful society. And America has enjoyed a relatively ahistorical period of peace and prosperity for the most part. In recent years, a tick up in the number of significant crime, shooting deaths and the like, has happened in a number of major American cities. And obviously one of these is Chicago. And so I'm curious as to your perspective on that issue, given that, we're talking in the aftermath of, sadly, one of the deadliest weekends that they've had in years, more than 80 people shot, more than 22 killed. And I was reading a story in the Chicago Tribune, I believe, today, it might have been the Sun-Times, that was going through just all of the different shooting deaths. And they're within like 10 minutes of each other, and sometimes within five blocks of each other, just an enormous level of violence. This seems to be a persistent problem. What kind of solutions can we offer? And what solutions would be in order, given that this seems to be an issue that Chicago has not really been able to resolve?
Right. So I'm not really a police expert, but here's a policing expert. Here's what I'm gonna share with you and your viewers and listeners. Four decades of economic data show us that a strong economy closes the gap between blacks and whites, the employment and income gaps between blacks and whites. And a lot of research, economic research, points to a positive relationship between the labor market outcomes, right? So employment, income, and negative relationship between labor market and crime. So if individuals are able to find opportunities, right, they engage in less crime, and the community sees less crime, especially violent crime, right? Property crime and violent crime. And so we have this relationship, and we know that to be true, that if individuals have opportunities and are allowed to thrive, then we're going to have safer communities. And when you look at the state of Illinois, since roughly 2010, we've had a serious out-migration crisis because of a lack of opportunity, right? So we had the Great Recession, after coming out of the Great Recession, the state of Illinois raised taxes, record high tax increase, that basically, hampered our economic recovery. We had a 10-year economic recovery, and the state was not able, despite tax increases, was not able to build a rainy day fund, because economic growth lagged. We had the worst personal income growth in the country for the entire period of the economic recovery, right? So you have a state that's struggling economically, and when you have economic struggles, they're disproportionately felt amongst minority communities, right? And so you end up with, less employment in minority communities and higher crime rates in those communities as well, right? So my prescription is let's fix the labor market, right? Let's get economic opportunities back to these communities. And the way we do that is not by raising taxes. It's not by hurting small business owners who are just trying to get by and try to create jobs for families. It's actually by giving them tax breaks, right? So property tax breaks, by giving them income tax breaks, by every incentive to continue to create new jobs. In Illinois, you have roughly 30% of all state expenditures going to pay for our huge pension debt, right? Whereas in other states, some of that money could have gone back to help communities or to actually cut taxes, right? In order to see this kind of robust labor market activity, right? So we see that if you look at all 50 states, states that have that create jobs at a faster rate tend to see a smaller gap between whites and blacks. And if you think about that carefully, it means that basically, as you have fewer and fewer people unemployed in the labor force, then employers cannot afford to discriminate, right? They just, if you discriminate, then it's going to take you a long time. It's very costly to find a similar worker to fill that position. So we see that states that are thriving economically see less discrimination in the labor market, right? And they see a smaller gap between whites and blacks. So it's really important to remember that economic fortunes are tied to are going to be tied to the fact that Illinois is suffering from the crime problem that we're seeing today, especially Chicago. Chicago is the largest city in Illinois, the city with the most black population as well.
So I want to talk to you for a moment about some of the more, let's say, fringe, but they seem to be less fringe these days, ideas that have been advocated for by some of the folks, particularly on the far left, who have been protesting and engaging in activism in the past couple of weeks. One idea that obviously has gotten a lot of attention in pieces written in prominent journals, including The Atlantic and The New York Times, is the idea of reparations. One that was supported by, or at least supported studying by, virtually every candidate for president from the Democratic side. Joe Biden's position is just that it will be studied. Others are in favor of it, emphatically. One of the few people to criticize it is actually Bernie Sanders, because he's more about class than about race for a number of reasons. But in terms of your own perspective on reparations, it seems to me that, one, it would be very difficult to adjudicate. Two, you would create all sorts of strange circumstances where white working class families descended from people who were formerly wealthy would be sending money to other people in ways that doesn't seem particularly fair. But just the very principle of reparations, what do you think about it, and what kind of steps could be done to address some of the inequities that you mentioned earlier without going that far?
I'll share a little bit of a personal story. I mean, having grown up, I was born and raised in Africa, right? So I was born in a small country in Africa that was a former French colony. Here's what I learned from basically rich governments sending money to poor governments. What I learned was that it didn't work, right? And what worked best was individuals, right? Being allowed to go and work, right? Find opportunities elsewhere, go to another country, work like myself. I'm in the US now, and sending money back home to their families, having their own goals and visions and focusing on their own activity and putting their kids through school, et cetera, et cetera. So these policies, although they sound really, really interesting and they seem good, always have unintended consequences. And so I'm not, I'm very skeptical of the idea that we're going to allow a government that put us in this position in the first place to try to get us out of it. I think that what we need to do is again, focus on how we get private individuals, right, and small businesses to climb out of this whole thing. And one of the ideas that I've been floating around, and I'm still working on this idea a little bit, is these special economic opportunity areas, right? So why not create a tax-free zone, a zone that where employers would be required to look for workers in that area who live and reside in that area, so you don't end up seeing so many families being displaced by new people coming into an area that could use the jobs. So those are ideas that are floating around. I haven't particularly studied the reparation issues, issue. But I think that, again, this is an idea that should be left to private individuals. Sure, you know, 400 years of slavery is going to do something. It's going to create a huge gap, and it has, right? You know, you see this huge wealth inequality. But, you know, we can't close that gap until we see we see racial tensions, number one, diminish. We see less political polarization and people coming together to come up with better solutions. You know, I think that ought to be step one. If you look at legislation across the country, very little legislation actually advances because there's so much polarization. You know, Democrats and Republicans at each other's throats all the time is a problem for this country if we're really serious about moving forward.
One of the gaps between the different economists on the right in recent years has been disagreement about the old approach to economic policy and newer approaches. And while it's going to be a little bit of an oversimplification, essentially that breaks down to Reagan era, Jack Kemp, Paul Ryan kind of policies that are focused just on lower taxes, have an assumption of trickle-down benefit, and advocate for free trade and a number of other things, against what we can fairly call, I think, a more populist and perhaps pro-family approach to economic policy, where the government will make more determinations about who ought to be receiving benefits, you know, increased child tax credits, increased benefits to families, and also slightly more protectionist policies when it comes to global trade and the like, designed to keep jobs here at home. Tell me a little bit about what you think about that debate, about where it kind of currently stands, and whether you think that there's a possibility for the Reaganauts to basically make a comeback in a climate where, you know, a lot of the gravity is moving toward a more Trumpian approach to policy within the Republican Party, certainly at the federal level.
So it's very interesting. As an economist, not a politician, I can tell you a couple of things. The first thing that I can tell you is that some people, especially on the left, see a big role for government to step in, right? So if you have very low economic growth, and things are dire, you know, you think, okay, well, if the private sector is not doing so well, then the government sector should step up, right? And there's some truth to that, right? So if aggregate demand, as we call it, falls because the private sector is not investing enough, there's some truth to the fact that maybe the public sector could try to pick up the slack. And a lot of economists who tend to be left-leaning have said that basically, yes, I mean, if you look at the cost of public debt, it's been falling. And if the cost of public debt has been falling, then maybe, right? And by the way, let me clarify what that argument means, right? So if you have, so imagine you're a household and your interest rates on your debt is falling, right? But your income is rising, right? Or at least is rising at a faster rate than the cost of your cost of living, basically, your debt, the cost of your debt, of servicing your debt, then you could probably afford to take on a little bit more debt because you expect to be able to pay it off without the need for a huge increase in income, right? So you take that context back to the government's sector. And if government is, the cost of government debt is falling, but aggregate income state income is increasing at a faster rate than the cost of servicing state debt, then you could make the case that the state could probably take on a little bit more debt without having to raise taxes in the future. So this is kind of the argument that we hear a lot on the left for why taking on more debt right now is not a terrible thing. And it's a very popular argument. It's very easy to for Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and all those people to jump on that bandwagon and say, hey, you know, here's a truth. Yes. Okay. But there's a big but coming, right? So, you know, this cost of debt will not stay low forever. You know, as we continue to jack up government spending, interest on our debt is bound to increase, and it's going to hurt everybody in the long run, because we'll have to eventually raise taxes to pay off the debt. So that argument has to be made. As to when it comes to the low taxes, argument versus on the right, the low taxes versus the more populist, let's close the border and take care of Americans first. Well, I've written extensively about that. Closing the border and restricting trade is actually going to hurt Americans a lot more than it's going to help them. And so we need to consider those things, right? So I think that, on the left and the right, these politicians like to polarize, to get people against each other. There are truths, there are things that are good from both sides that we need to put together. And so we need to be able to work together and discuss these things fully, instead of shutting down the other side and not trying to engage in that conversation. So again, I think political polarization is toxic. It hurts economic growth. And I think we need to come together as a country, whether we are, on the left or the right, whether we're big Reagan supporters or not. And we need to come together as a country and start having this discussion about what's sound economic policy in this environment. Again, this is an environment that we haven't seen before since the Great Depression. I mean, this is a serious downturn. And until we come together, we're not going to be able to help Americans, unfortunately.
Do you think people make the mistake too often of assuming that the stock market represents the economy?
Absolutely. I think everybody, including economists, make the mistake of thinking that that the stock market represents the economy. I mean, it helps to, when you look at the stock market doing so well at times, it makes you think, at least, that people are confident, right? Confidence is important, right? As I always say, a very cheap form of stimulus is getting people confident about the future. If they think that things are going to improve, then they're going to spend more. And if they spend more, the economy will grow, right? So when people look at the stock market and they see the stock market surging in a downturn, maybe there's some confidence there. Maybe it's a little, we're a little overconfident. And that's what we're seeing, the things we're seeing. So there's a little danger there.
Is your family still in Africa, or are they here?
So my parents are in Africa. My direct family, wife and kids, are right here with me in the state of Illinois. And so, of course, I care very much about the direction of the state and where the state is going. I got a 3-year-old, who's about to go to pre-K and it's going to start school soon. And unfortunately, we're at this point where we consider, okay, well, is the public school system in Illinois one that we can rely on or not, right? And yeah. I wrote a paper not too long ago that showed that basically, as long as we have in Illinois, we have way too many school districts. And as long as we have more administrators than we have teachers, classroom outcomes are going to lag the outcomes in other states. So that's a big problem. And I look at all these things and I care very much about the direction of the state of Illinois.
Can I ask, have you talked at all to your parents about their perspective on what's going on of late, both the coronavirus and then protests that have not just broken out in America, but in Europe as well, in other places around the world, about these policing issues and racial disparities and the like?
Yes, briefly, I mean, if you talk to a lot of people in the Black community, this is something we're all familiar with, right? So yeah. I remember, even myself, I remember being a wide-eyed teenager coming to America for the first time. I think I was about 16 years old. And we had some friends in Westchester County, Illinois, New York, Westchester County, New York. And I went to visit a friend up in a small town called Tarrytown, New York, which is predominantly white. And I had missed the train. And I was sitting there at the train station. It was kind of late at night. I missed the last train. And I was sitting at the train station, and five police cars converged. And they grabbed me, threw me against the hood of the car, and basically searched me, aggressively searched me, because they thought I had, I had never seen drugs in my life, right? I was this innocent kid, in a foreign country on vacation, visiting friends.
You were how old?
I was 16 years old, right? And I thought, okay, what do I do now, right? So I was there. And then when they realized that I was a minor, they took me into the police station, gave me some hot chocolate, and called my parents, right? So things like that, Black Americans are very familiar with.
Yeah.
To some extent, I'm glad that the world gets to see this. And I'm also very happy and very proud to see so many people who have responded by saying, race doesn't matter. We should stand against police injustice. There's no reason why police officers will patrol patrol in the suburbs and wave at people in a very friendly manner. And when they enter a disproportionately black area, people disperse, they run away because it's a police car. Instead of waving at the police. I think it's a big problem. I'm glad the world is aware of it now, and that people are standing with the black community, with minorities, and saying, all right, this is too much. We need to put an end to it. What I'm sad about is the looters jumping in the mix of protesters, who are there to try to, voice the fact that there's been a terrible injustice done. These looters come in and distract away from reform. Mm-hmm. This should bring us to the table, should bring everybody to the table to talk about how we reform this broken system.
And you get the feeling that, certainly some of it is motivated by, a perspective on racial animus, but you get just as much of a feeling that a lot of these people who are engaging in the actual violent behavior are just looking for an excuse to be violent. Are just looking for a crowd that they can hide in after they set something on fire or after they steal something, as opposed to sending some kind of political message about the need for police reform. It's frustrating, I think, to look at the coverage that this has received and to basically have a media category that is just, these are all looters and rioters, or on the other hand, that is like, oh, well, there are no looters and rioters, or if there are, then they're justified. I mean, the perspective of Nicole Hannah Jones from the New York Times that she said last week on CBS was, she said destruction of property is not violence. And that, if you can replace it, that means it's not violence. How can you push back? How can you argue against someone who basically has the perspective that any kind of destruction is justified? By what they view as accurately injustice, as particularly, in many instances, historically racial. We don't know in this instance whether the cop's motivation was racially based or not, but certainly injustice.
It's definitely not justice. It's actually going to hurt blacks and Hispanics more. Because you look at the data, and anytime there's an economic downturn, who the first ones are to lose their jobs? It's black people, right? Black men and women in particular are first to lose their jobs in an economic downturn. You destroy property, you hurt the economy. And by doing that, you're actually hurting the people you're trying to help. You have a robust economic recovery, and you see black Americans thrive, and you see the gap between whites and blacks diminish. Only recently we had the lowest black unemployment rate in decades, mm-hmm. right? Prior to COVID-19, we were seeing improvements in terms of labor market outcomes for blacks. And so again, destruction of property is not good. Any policy that hurts economic growth is not good. It's damaging, especially for those communities that need the economy to thrive, they need those communities that need the jobs. So again, I'm going to say that, we have to promote a strong economic recovery. One of the ways to do that is, first of all, move away from these strict lockdowns, right? So these strict lockdowns actually prevent people from going back to work and earning a paycheck. And that actually disproportionately hurts Blacks and Hispanic minority workers, right? Who are less likely to be able to perform work at home, right? So it's a problem. And some people will say, well, what about the fact that, COVID-19 might actually hurt them? And I say, look, there are good ways to lift the lockdowns. You know, we should be using science, right? And by science, I mean, there's research that shows that hospitalization rates, depend on the prevalence of disease in the communities, of pre-existing conditions. We have very good medical records. Why is it that we're not using them, right? So if somebody is at risk, that person should be encouraged to stay home. But if your risk of getting hospitalized is much higher, then you should be encouraged to stay home. And your government, for example, Illinois, if we had a rainy day fund, could actually provide support for these families and businesses, for these people who are more at risk of hospitalization. But unfortunately, public policy has failed them, and public policy continues to fail them by restricting them from earning a paycheck, because what it's doing, it's hurting the communities that it was trying to protect in the first place.
Dr. Orfe Devungai is the chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute. You can follow him on Twitter at PolicyQuantsPhD. Thank you so much, Orfe, for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.